on a Wednesday. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. It's June 4th. It's Pride Month.
It is.
We just had the Pride celebration here in Philadelphia over the weekend, and all of this comes at a particularly fragile moment for the LGBTQ plus community in this region and in this country. A crossroads, perhaps. We'll get into the details of all of that later this hour. What's happening locally, state level, federally. But our big question for you this hour is this. What do you think about the state of LGBTQ plus issues under the Trump administration? Kind of a broad question this hour, but we've got two great panelists coming in the second and third segments to discuss a wide range of issues. So basically, the question for you is, you got thoughts on this topic? Give us a call. Give us an email. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Of course, you know, if you're on the YouTube chat, you can drop a comment right there.
Yeah. I look forward to hearing from my listeners. I think this is definitely a caller and a listener participation show.
Now that you said that, people got a call.
Now they got a call.
Do not leave us embarrassed, folks.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot has happened with the LGBTQ plus community over the past 10, 15 years. And a lot of our listeners were around for all of this change. And so this could be a flashpoint moment. You may not see that, but I definitely want to hear what you think. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org.
And how about a trio of local news stories now, Cherry, to kick us off? You start.
Oh, yes. A New York developer has some big plans for the 1.4 million square foot Wanamaker building. They want to build 600 loft-style apartments and a whole lot more above the former Macy's space. You see the headline right there from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Today, they're reporting that TF Cornerstone just won control of the 8 floors above the former Macy's. And I went to say goodbye to Macy's back in March.
Yeah, folks, don't remember, this is the Macy's building, the Wanamaker building right there on Market Street. That's a legendary building here in Philadelphia. And Macy's just departed.
They did. And now the developer that owns it, they just took control of the office space above the Macy's, as well as the underground parking garage, at a foreclosure auction this week. And they want to build those 600 loft apartments on some of the floors. They want to keep office space on a couple of the floors. The Crystal Tea Room that a lot of people may be familiar with. It's still going to be there. They're still going to have events there. But the space that where the Macy's used to be will eventually be converted into a quote, well-curated retail space. The Grand Court that everybody loves and the Wanamaker Organ that people so love, that will still be open to the public.
And it's still going to be an organ, it sounds
Yeah, it sounds like.
It'll still make music.
And construction for all of this is expected to begin in the first quarter of next year. So pretty soon.
Yeah, and look, people are going to have an issue with whatever they turn this building into because it's such a beloved building.
It is.
However, when you look at the range of options, department store clearly wasn't going to work. It was the last department store on this stretch, Market East. Everyone else had closed. Macy's couldn't make it work anymore. Department store, that idea,
gone.
Put it to the side. We've heard for years now that post-COVID, Center City needs to become more of a 24/7 neighborhood, more residential.
Yeah.
So bring in residents. I mean, it makes sense with the trends that we're seeing in downtown spaces to build mixed use. You want some retail, you want some living. Will it work? That's more the question for me, because the plan sounds good, but converting these types of buildings is very difficult and very costly. And sometimes developers walk away from those projects.
And by the way, people wondering about this TF Touchstone, will they walk away? TF Cornerstone. And they are very experienced developers. They have about 12,000 units of apartments in New York City. They've also done.
But this is Philly.
And this is their first project in
Philly. This is Philly, man.
So we'll see if they can deal with all the Philadelphia red tape and what'll happen with that. But we'll be watching.
This is Philly, man. Okay.
That's a good one.
Story number two. And this will shock many of you who grew up with chalkboards and, I don't know, yardsticks or whatever. If you walk into a Philadelphia public school today, mm-hmm. at this point, Cherry, you will not find a single working old school water fountain.
What?
Can you believe that?
No.
Now, it sounds like a bad thing, but it's actually a good thing.
Okay,
Kristen Graham at the Philadelphia Inquirer reports the school district has now finished installing filtered hydration stations in all of its buildings. This comes 3 years after testing showed lead contamination in nearly all of those old school unfiltered water fountains.
Mm-hmm.
In 2022, City Council passed a law saying, school district, you have to install these filtered water bottle filling stations to replace the fountains. And they have met that requirement actually on schedule,
wow.
which feels like a rarity, right? So
mm-hmm.
So now you walk into a school building in Philadelphia, at least a public school, and you have all the new age water bottle filling things and no more old school water fountains, which is shocking to think about. That's all we used back in the day,
I know.
Cherry.
We had analog childhoods, man. And, you know, I'm so glad, first of all, that the school district saw
We're
this
old.
Problem. And on time.
Breaking news. We're old.
You know, and they have a lot of other environmental issues that they're dealing with.
Yes,
and they got
yes.
this one right. But, you know, like I said, just the idea of water fountains no longer working. We were analog children. You know, things like you said, chalkboards.
Yeah.
You know.
It's all smartboards now, man.
I mean, yeah. And think about it. There are no more pay phones. We've said goodbye to so many things. Overhead projectors. Remember those? When the teacher used to have a little squeaky, like, markers and stuff.
I remember them. I don't know if I remember them fondly.
Yeah, I
hated
them.
Because it felt like the teacher never knew how to use it.
And it never
they
worked.
They were like, doing
light.
It the wrong way. Yeah, the pen didn't work.
You know, and I mean, think about it. Paper report cards. Now all the kids get their report cards digitally. I mean, and I still have one of my paper report cards from
and
back
for
in the
me,
day.
And for me, I actually had to walk uphill both ways in the snow. I don't know about you.
We're going back. Because my nieces and nephews all were like, you were born in the 1900s, auntie. Yes, I was.
The 1900s.
Yes, I was. All right.
I prefer to call it the 20th century. It sounds more modern that way. Okay, so third story. We're not talking about water and fountains anymore. We're talking about water and sand, right? Here
yeah.
we go.
To all my beachgoers, shout out to NJ.com. They dropped their 2025 edition list of etiquette rules that'll keep you from being hated on the beach.
So okay. 15 rules to follow at the beach.
Yeah, 15 rules. These are etiquette rules. And by the way, the article starts, New Jersey has the best beaches in the world, .. But it doesn't matter how great a beach is if the people at the beaches don't know how to act. And you know me.
I do.
And I kind of, I give shade to the shore, okay? Because
not
I feel like
they... Not like a beach umbrella shade.
No,
different
like,
type of
different
shade.
Different type of shade because they have so many rules. And I'm not a fan of all the rules. And so I was objecting to this list before I even read it. Okay.
But
then, you know, what had happened was, oh my goodness.
Oh my gosh.
But then what had happened was,
you gotta be on YouTube for this. I can't even describe this picture,
but, they had some rules that I kind of agreed with. You know what I mean?
So these are 15 etiquette rules from NJ.com. What were some of their rules?
Okay. So one, they said, you need to learn how to park. Okay, because there's too many people out here doing the parking in two spaces, and you know parking is limited. I kind of agree with that. I have a pet peeve about bad parking. Okay,
it seems self-evident, but yeah.
No smoking.
Well, smoking's illegal.
Yeah,
anyways.
Smoking's illegal yeah. anyway. And then they said exhibit sand awareness. They hate people that are kicking the sand around, and because it's windy, you start running, you're kicking sand. Be aware of that. They also said clean up after yourself.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and play games on the side. And as someone whose head is a magnet for like volleyballs and beach balls, you know what I mean? Yes, I agree. I've been hit in the head by one of those beach balls like several times. And I know I got big head, big hair, but still, play on the side, people.
You really sound like a killjoy. I'm not gonna lie here, Cherry.
It goes against my anti-rule stance. Yeah. I know.
I mean, for me, the beach is a big playground. If you want like peace and quiet, get a backyard.
Ooh.
Bombs dropped.
Boom.
This is the beach. It's for everybody. It's for whatever they want to do. Someone shouldn't invade your personal space, but I don't know. Play your beach games. They had a crazy one in here,
yeah.
which was put on sunscreen. I'm sorry, but it's my choice whether or not to put on sunscreen.
If you want to turn into a lobster, go ahead.
Exactly.
Like, that's your individual right.
This is America. Okay. But like...
I want to play that song, This is America. Yeah, go ahead.
I understand it's advisable to put on sunscreen, but how is that a rule? I will say one rule that I would propose for the shore. I think it would make sense to have a system where the people who want to set up like the bigger shade tents do that like in the back. Like just have a zone a little further away for the big shade tents that obstruct everyone else.
Because you need to be able to see the water.
Well, yeah. But that's more about organization than rules. Also, more foot washing stations, please. We need more of those.
Yeah.
I'm putting it on the beaches. I feel like the people are cool. The beaches need to like get their stuff together.
Yeah. By the way, whatever. We'll be right back after this break.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
I am a straight person, and I do not really stay awake nights worrying about, like, unisex bathrooms. Somebody else's sex life is none of my business.
Him taking away the gay marriages, that's what I'm worried about.
I think trans rights especially, like, we just have to be watching out for our whole community.
Probably trans rights in America. I think they're under a lot of attack, specifically from the administration currently, and a lot of, like, state and local policies seem to be kind of jumping on that.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You just heard from Kathleen, Jarrett, Jahl, and Ben, who spoke to us yesterday in the Washington Square West neighborhood. Over the last century, LGBTQ plus Americans have become increasingly visible. With that visibility has come a suite of new legal rights and protections. But the first few months of the Trump administration suggest a changing tide.
Grants targeted toward LGBTQ plus health, canceled. Transgender service members, banned. And as we embark on the first Pride Month of this presidential term, we ask, what does the future look like for LGBTQ plus people in this country?
With us today, we have two members of the community with very different political backgrounds. Deja Alvarez is an activist and advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. Deja, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
We also have us joined by Zoom, Albert Eisenberg, Republican political consultant and principal at the political communications firm Blue State Red. Albert, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And our question for you, our listeners, what do you think about the state of LGBTQ plus issues under the Trump administration? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, hello, drop a comment right there in the chat.
And so, you know, Deja and Albert, before we get into specific measures and actions under the Trump administration, I want to hear from both of you. I mean, we're 10 years out from the Supreme Court decision that granted same-sex marriage to all Americans. Well, granted or legalized, I should say, same-sex marriage, made marriage equality throughout the country. And so for folks who came before that age, right, for folks who are coming up now, I want you to kind of put this moment in context when it comes to LGBTQ plus history and rights. And we'll start with you, Deja, and then Albert will have you chime in as well.
Okay. I was around back then. I remember when the case Obergefell was kind of hitting the airwaves, and the level of excitement and angst behind it. Because for so many years, people that were part of the LGBTQ plus community could not openly love who they wanted to love. They couldn't put a picture of their partner on their desk at work. They couldn't talk about their partner at work. They had to be careful what social environments they were in, whether they, you know, acknowledged they had a partner or not. So for so many people who lived through that, to then be able to kind of wipe away that fear and celebrate their love, just like the rest of the world gets to celebrate, you know, their love, was amazing to see. It was amazing, you know, to watch the excitement and how many people went and got married right after that. And people that had been together for 20, 30, 40, some even 50 years, finally they could get married. And now we're looking at going backwards. We're looking at taking a right that should have been freely given, you know, decades before that, taken away. And so I think, you know, they maybe use the example like it's easier to be poor and stay poor than it is to be rich and then become poor. So I think for people that are married, because people don't think about it, you get the benefits, your partner's insurance, your, you know, life insurance, health insurance, all of that kind of stuff is all kind of combined with being able to be married according to our tax laws and et cetera.
Yeah. And Albert, I wanted you to just chime in, like how you see this moment, you know, when you talk about LGBTQ rights and history over the years.
Yeah, I mean, good to zoom out at the start of Pride Month. I am 34. I remember quite well growing up in the suburbs of Philadelphia and it not being a comfortable environment for gay, but certainly not for transgender people, not that I can speak to that. And the amount of societal and cultural change we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years, it's been a fascinating journey across the political spectrum. And we have become incredibly comfortable as out gay and transgender adults and people who are allied with us across the political spectrum. I mean, I remember when there was no Republicans or Democrats that, I mean, very few were coming out for even marriage equality. That's changed quite a bit. Congress has codified certain LGBT rights as well. But what we have in 2025 is overall, I think when we talk about a vibe shift or a tone shift, is the pendulum swinging so far between 2015 and 2024, I would say, towards the progressive left on a number of cultural, hot button cultural issues, race, gender, sexuality, top among them, and a sort of vibe check backwards. And LGBT, the umbrella rights, quote unquote, are not exempt from that. I think when we talk about where the goalposts have shifted now, I mean, the really key hot button issues for me as a gay man and just as an American are medicalizing children and transition of under 18-year-olds. You know, I think that the fact that we're debating that right now shows how far the movement has come, but also shows, I think, a lot of the overreach that a lot of people, including a lot of Democrats and centrists, would oppose. And, you know, drag queen story hour. But really, the goalposts have shifted so much. And the Overton window has also shifted, thanks to, I think, the LGBT sort of political establishment, what you're allowed to say and can't say and what we're allowed to debate openly. And that, I think, is causing some harm to our community. And it's causing approval rates for gay marriage to go down, actually, I think, due to sort of the censoriousness of the LGBT left, and I'm pretty concerned about it.
Well, Deja, let me get your response to that. So I think Albert's argument, if I'm summarizing it correctly, is that basically the movement went too far, it's triggered a backlash, and that backlash threatens some of the bedrock rights that were won through, let's say, like the first 15 years of the 21st century. Do you think
can I add just one thing really quick?
Sure.
The quote that was used to get marriage across the finish line was, "We just want to be left alone. We just want to love who we love, and we just want to be left alone." And I think that shifted significantly from "We just want to be left alone, leave us alone," to enforced, you know, celebrations from corporations and, you know, on high school districts lying to parents about what's in curriculum. Like, it has gone so much further than that. So that's
Deja, this sort of it's gone too far argument, and it's, you know, like a threat to the overall, you know, civil rights of the community. Your response to that?
I think that is a lazy white man's argument.
In what way?
Because it's easy when you're really only fighting for one thing. Like, I just want to be able to be married and be left alone. Mm-hmm. Then the rest of your life isn't affected by whatever else happens. I think that if you're going to talk about the LGBTQ plus community, you have to talk about it as a whole. And transgender and non-binary people are a part of that community. Mm-hmm. As far as if you want to start discussing medicalizing children, let's talk about the facts, not the propaganda that the right, the Republicans, actually thrive off of, because they know that their base is less educated and lower IQ.
And so, Deja, if you want to, we're going to jump right into that, clearly.
I mean,
And I'll get you to start this. What do you think has been sort of the dividing line where there's a misconception when it comes to this issue?
Well, the dividing line is outright lies. You know, the Republican, the current administration, the Republican Party getting up on microphones, getting up on stages and saying children are being given sex changes in schools and children are having their private parts cut off and children. That's not happening. What actually happens, the only thing that an underage child can medically do is take a hormone blocker, which actually does not do anything but slow down your puberty for you to be able to make a decision about yourself as you get older. Once you are taken off of that puberty blocker, then if you stop that puberty blocker, your body continues to develop, you continue to develop just like normal. So they've radicalized this fake idea that we're out here forcing children into this life and becoming transgender. And, you know, a lot of gay white men feel the same way that he does.
Well, let me ask you then, Albert, because I know you want to respond, you want to jump in. So you said that sort of the core argument that advanced the movement so much was like a libertarian argument. We want to be left alone. Does the ability to get a medical procedure or take some medication if you want to, does that not fit under the umbrella of, you know, I want to be left alone. I want to sort of be free to choose the life I want to choose. You know, I'm paying for it. I'm, you know, doing it on my own free will.
Yeah. I mean, first let's just address Deja's line of, attack. Those were, first of all, you don't know me. And to say that I'm a lazy white man when we're trying to have an intellectual discussion is personal. And I don't
appreciate it. Personally, I'm you don't so know my sorry. Background.
You don't know my background and you don't know anything about me. And I will say there are people that are medically transitioning who regret it, who are under 18. If you're talking
what's
about
what's that percentage? How many?
Significant, but all of the studies show exactly. that 80% of children under 18s with gender dysphoria end up doing what's called desisting, which is growing up and accepting their bodies as is, complicated as that is. That is what we should hope for, because the idea that every 16 or 15 year old biological female, a lot of whom are on the spectrum, by the way, all of the studies show that the huge explosion in transgender youth has been biological female XX chromosomes who are also on the spectrum and have other mental health issues. I do not believe, and I think a lot of people listening right now do not believe, that you can consent to getting a double mastectomy at 17 and permanently losing the ability to breastfeed. That is the reality that has happened across the United States.
So you're arguing there is like there is a sort of live and let live idea that you ascribe to, but that it stops for younger people, that there should be sort of a different...
My argument is that you cannot consent to permanent body modifications that are going to lead you to a lifetime of infertility, potentially inability to orgasm, potentially never being able to breastfeed your child at 17, especially if you have other extenuating health symptoms. And one other fact that Deja may or may not want to deal with is France, the UK, Sweden, Australia, and many other countries have moved away from the gender affirmation model, which is basically saying, okay, your child comes in, they're 14 years old and they have gender dysphoria, get them on hormones immediately. Every other country besides the United States has moved away from that. There's a reason for it. It is not evidence-based. It's not humane. Yeah. It's actually a human rights issue. And we are currently causing the medicalization of many youth who would grow up to be normal adult gay and lesbian adults.
Normal
and they're
adult,
causing bodily harm to people. And many of them have come out as detransitioners and many of them have committed suicide because they've been so.
And I just want to take a moment, because I know this is a very personal issue for a lot of people. And this is a, you know, civil dialogue. We want to keep it civil. I know people, you know, everybody has a lot of passion about this. So we just want to bring the temperature down a little bit so that people can really hear what's being said. And I know, Deja, you want to respond to what Albert had to say. And so you have the floor.
Well, it's funny to me that Albert started out with, we just want to be left alone. And I can't, and he said something about transgender, but then he said, I really can't speak to that. And then he just spent the last 2.5 minutes speaking about transgender people and how they feel and how they detransition and the level of suicide. It's almost a 40% suicide rate amongst LGBTQ youth. And that has nothing to do with transitioning. It has everything to do with societal views. It has everything to do with the political persecution that we experience, particularly as transgender people. It has to do with the poverty that transgender people live in, because people that are gay cannot necessarily relate to being transgender. A lot of people that are gay, they just think, oh, you just went one step too far. Why couldn't you just be happy being, you know, a gay person instead of having to be transgender? So yeah. I find it a little bit hypocritical, as I do most of the stances mm-hmm. from the right, that, oh, we just want to be left alone. But then let me tell you what's going on. And you're using propaganda and not even factual stuff, because the majority, I work in this field.
Yes.
And the majority of transgender youth are not getting hormones. They're getting puberty blockers. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between.
And you're, just to clarify your position on that, your position mm-hmm. is no matter the age, that if a doctor feels puberty blocker should be prescribed, they should be able to prescribe it if that's what the patient asks for.
Well, the standard is nobody under 14.
14. So you think 14 should be the line. And I think what Albert was saying is that 18 or 19 should be the line.
So that's the different.
But then Albert went on to say, you know, a 17-year-old is getting a double mastectomy. They're getting surgeries that are affecting their ability to orgasm. A double mastectomy does not affect your ability to have an orgasm, first of all. Secondly, if a 17-year-old, I know at my age, and most of the transgender people that I know, they knew who they were when they were very young, but because there was no support system, they weren't able to verbalize it, they weren't able to actualize it, they weren't able to understand it.
Can I just pick real quick, Albert, like mm-hmm. what would your prescription be then if you don't think there should be any sort of medical intervention between, say, 14 or 19? And you never said an age, so feel free to correct me on that, but what should you then do to make sure a person who really wants to proceed down that path, you know, doesn't feel hopeless, despairing, and mm-hmm. have the sort of, you know, and obviously we talked about, by the way, we should go about the number 988 is the national suicide hotline if you do have ideas of self-harm.
Which is being cut off, by the
but,
way.
But so let me just ask you, like, what would be sort of your policy prescription then for helping young people in that position if indeed you don't think puberty blockers or any type of medical intervention is appropriate?
I think that's a good way to level set the conversation. So my perspective is that I do not think that medical transition should be allowable before the age of 18. I don't think it's humane. And the all of the metadata, all of this psychological long-term surveys show that a super majority of youth that have gender dysphoria, which is feeling that your body and your soul do not match, grow out of it and come to acceptance in their own bodies, which is far, that should be what we want as adults, because you're signing up for a lifetime of medical treatments and some difficult situations if you cannot live comfortably in your own body. It's very difficult, and parents agonize over this, as do children. My position is that you should be respectful to anybody, as far as, you know, transition. I think social transition is perfectly normal. And a good thing for parents to encourage. I think parents should be, and schools should be, accepting of students who want to socially transition if it feels like it's a deep set issue for them. And then once they become adults, they can make decisions about their own health. What I'm not in favor of is blocking puberty, which really that's a euphemism. You can't, the human body, you can't block anything. You can't, we're not infinitely malleable. You can't just pause certain things, and things like permanent bone damage occur when you block puberty.
I understand where you guys differ now. I just want to make sure we have time to get some callers. What I'm also not for is
taking custody away from parents who don't affirm their children's pronouns. I'm definitely not for that. I'm definitely not for schools and school districts and guidance counselors coaching students to use pronouns and not informing their parents.
And I just want to bring in a caller right now. Yeah, we have Yvette from New Brunswick, New Jersey online too. We have people waiting to get into the conversation, so we're just going to bring them in. Yvette from New Brunswick, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my comment and a question. I am a clinical social worker, and I work with people within the LGBT plus community. And there's always been higher rates of mental health concerns because of the societal impact. And now we're looking at the administration saying they're no longer going to fund the National Suicide Hotline for LGBTQ youth. You know, that I'm seeing clients who are really struggling with anxiety, depression, their fear of their safety, and then just the bottom line of the administration demonizing, plus the dismantling of healthcare services and research related to LGBT community. We are putting ourselves a decade behind by assuming that LGBTQ people don't exist. Mm-hmm. So for the person who said, oh, well, you know, we should just not do anything, my question is, how does invisibility of a person help our nation?
And thank you.
Let me bring in another caller just to back these two things. So that was Yvette from New Brunswick. Let's keep that in mind. And here on line one is Joe from Atlantic City. Hey, Joe, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective here?
Hey, on the idea that LGBTQ people are invisible and the only reason that we're still going is because we have flags in the street, we have flags all over everything, we have to have a whole month dedicated to this. If it's a social issue, number one, why is legislation even involved? There's no civil rights, anything going on. Respect for Marriage Act was passed in 2022. We can still get married. There's issues with trans kids. Sure, that's going on. That's its own thing in my mind. But the constant need for visibility and directly relating it to the mental health of individuals, I just think is absolutely wrong. I was walking around New Hope, Pennsylvania the other day. There's these pride flags all over everything. I'm a gay man. I see them. They're ugly. They're absolutely ugly. Why throw it in everybody's face?
Okay.
And that's Joe from Atlantic City. By the way, I want to reiterate our phone number, 888-477-9499. You can participate in the conversation also via email, studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comments in the chat. And Deja, I know you want to respond to this. Go right ahead.
Yeah. And again, you know, here's another gay man that, oh, it's too much. Oh, it's too much. What do we need to be visible for? But gay marriage was passed. We're good. That's literally what this man just said. When in fact, there's an entire part of the community that is suffering. And they're not suffering because of medical transition. They're suffering because, and he raised this point. He said, you know, because a lot of them just go back to being normal gay and lesbian. Well, first of all, I don't know what part of the Republican Party he's a part of, but for most of the Republican Party, being gay and lesbian is not considered normal.
Secondly,
it's kind of obvious.
Is it kind of obvious? Because I work in Republican politics, and you can use my name if you want to refer to me, Deja.
Secondly, visibility is important because without visibility, we would have never even been able to get gay marriage. We would have never been, and let me be clear, as a trans woman, gay marriage doesn't affect me. It does not affect me. That doesn't allow me or disallow me to get married. I can still get married. But this idea from a lot of gay, particularly white men, that, you know, hey, we got gay marriage, so that's all we need. We're good now. The rest of y'all can fend for yourself. As far as the one thing that person said is, yeah, why are politicians involved in our personal lives? What difference does it make to you if I'm trans or if I'm sleeping with a man or a woman or a non-binary person? It's none of your business.
So we do have a break coming up, and I know you want to respond, Albert. I promise I will give you that chance on the other side of this break. But let me read out the number again and maybe a couple more comments. We have the number is 888-477-9 four 99. David on YouTube says, I wish we had more examples like Pete Buttigieg in the current administration. At least Trump appointed Richard Grenell, an openly gay man, as acting director of national intelligence. Sharon emails us, I'm absolutely horrified at the Trump administration's actions. These are human beings absolutely entitled to living and loving. The administration has no humanity. So we've been on this one debate for a while, but maybe we could broaden it a little bit on the other side of this break and talk about other things happening in this space. You're listening to Studio 2. Stick with us on WHYY. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Before we go back into our discussion about the LGBTQ plus community, we have a big announcement.
And here it is. Beginning next week, we'll be live on Mondays in addition to our Tuesday through Thursday lineup. That means, yes, we are adding one. Thanks for your applause, Deja. Yes, we're adding one more week, hour a week of our show right here on WHYY and on our YouTube live stream.
And that is Monday, June 9th. It's less than a week away. So mark your calendars, and I hope you will join us for our very first Monday show. And of course, every Monday at noon after that.
So let's return now to our conversation about LGBTQ rights under the Trump administration. And let me reintroduce our guests. With us in studio is Deja Alvarez, activist and advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. And remotely from Washington, D.C., we have Albert Eisenberg, a Republican political consultant and principal at the political communications firm Blue State Red.
And we also want to hear from you, our listeners. Our question of the day is this. What do you think about the state of LGBTQ plus issues under the Trump administration? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, share the link with your friends and also leave those questions and comments in the live chat.
So, Albert, returning to something we were talking about before the break, I think I'm identifying maybe a key difference between the two of you here, which is that you feel like sort of the left's agenda on this issue triggered the backlash. And Deja is sort of identifying another sort of string of events, which is that one part of the community got a key civil right and protection, mm-hmm. and that sort of that let them kind of opt out of the rest of the conversation. How do you respond to that criticism?
Yeah, I think we're living in 2025. And the fact is that we have an out trans woman and an out gay man having a discussion on public radio for a large audience, a hopefully mostly respectful discussion on the issues. And we're actually pretty lucky. I mean, when I was growing up, there was hardly any gay people on TV, and things have changed quite a bit. We're living in an era where RuPaul's Drag Race is one of the most prominent franchises culturally. Respect for gay and transgender adults is pretty ubiquitous as far as polling. People are out much more than they used to be, and that's all a good thing. My stance is that people who are adults can do what they want to do. And most people agree with me. Most Americans, left, right, and center, agree with me. And despite some of the things that were said in the last segment, actually, I've been the only gay person in the room in a lot of very Republican spaces, and I've gotten very little flack for it. I get more flack being an out conservative among gay people and trans people than I do being an out gay man among Republicans. And that is just the tea. So I'm just going to tell you that right there. That's just the reality of it.
And so that's why my question for you, Albert, is this. I mean, yes, when ma'am. Your line is at adults versus children. And so then it goes to trans people in the military. So these are adults who relied on the openness of the U.S. military, disclosed their status as trans to the military. And now, under the Trump administration, could very well lose benefits. You have people who have fought for their country, who have served their country nearer in that 20 year. And I'm married to somebody who was in the military. That 20 year mark is key, right? And so now they're being told that they have to leave. Your response to that part, because these are adults who have choices and who have dedicated their lives to serving their country.
Yeah, great question, Jerry. The military, the first question we have to ask, the military is not a social experiment. The military is not a feel-good, rah-rah thing. We have to ask, is China worried about this issue? China's not worried about this issue. We have enormous threats as a country. The world has gotten much less stable over the last 10 or 20 years. The absolute first question, and everything else is 20 steps below this to me, is what is good for troop cohesion? What is good for readiness? Because we are going to have hot wars escalating all over the globe with Iran, with China and Taiwan, with Russia. And if I would like to see data on troop cohesion as far as having medically transitioning troops in the platoons with other troops, I could see the argument both ways. But really what concerns me when it comes to our military readiness is the fact that we just met our army recruiting, our military recruiting goals 4 months early for the first time in many years, which is something we should all celebrate. Yeah. And that's what I want to put first and foremost on the conversation. As far as individual troops, I think it's amazing that people step up and serve the country. I give my respect to them. And I'm going to trust that people are who are making decisions are doing it for readiness and troop cohesion. I think that has to be the second and third question.
Just to follow up on that, this is a quote, and it mirrors very eerily something you just said, from Kenneth Royal, who was the Secretary of the Army in 1949. He said, "The Army is not an instrument for social evolution." And he was using that argument to, you know, argue against desegregating the military. So you could always say that, you know, allowing one group or the other to serve could trigger a backlash among other troops. I'm trying to understand why that would be kind of the guiding principle here, as opposed to sort of a bedrock commitment to, you know, civil liberties.
Well, I mean, first of all, there's an incredibly small adult transgender population. If you're asking me to defend segregating troops, I'm not going to do that. That obviously needed to happen. And that was much more important for troop readiness and helped us win World War II, is, you know, and be more prepared for the wars to come against the USSR. I don't think integrating or non-integrating transgender troops, I mean, it's a very small portion of active troops. And I could see, you know, you just ask a number of, let's say, biological women, whether they're going to be comfortable showering and getting ready with a biological man. I think that a lot of racial and ethnic minorities might resent that being compared to racial integration, because it's just different and it's a little odd.
Wait, so how is it different? I'm just trying to understand how it's different, because that was the argument in 1949, was that you could not desegregate the military because it made other troops uncomfortable, not because it was a good or bad thing overall, that it would hurt specifically troop cohesion and recruitment. Are you saying that that same effect is possible for allowing transgender people to openly serve?
That seemed to be the argument you were making. Talking about 20% of the country who wasn't allowed to serve when we were in a world war.
No, they were allowed to serve. They were serving in segregated units.
Or separated out. I mean, going through hoops to do this kind of thing, it's completely different. And it's sort of like when the first gay basketball player came out and all these left-leaning institutions were comparing him to Jackie Robinson. I mean, it's kind of insulting, don't you think, to compare those two? It's just a little like, I don't know. I mean,
but it seemed like you were making the same argument.
You're talking about less than 1% of the adult population who are going to be getting naked and showering with people, and the proportion of female, you know, people in the military who are going to be uncomfortable with that is extremely high. So I just, I mean, one of them's right and one of them's wrong, and I'm not really taking a stance on the transgender ban of troops in general. I just think that troop cohesion needs to be first and foremost. And I think that the determination they made in 1949 was that troop cohesion will work with interracial integrated platoons, or whatever you call them, and that was the decision that was made. And then America ended up doing, you know, having a strong military for many years. So that was the decision.
And by the way, the Trump administration announced that it would no longer allow some trans members of the military to serve their country after an executive order was challenged in court and decided in favor of the Trump administration. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth laid out the plan to discharge these members of the military in accordance with that order. And I want folks to just hear what the secretary had to say. I want to play that clip.
Service members who have a current diagnosis or history of or exhibit symptoms consistent with gender dysphoria may elect to separate voluntarily. There's a timeline here, and then eventually involuntarily if necessary. This is the president's agenda. This is what the American people voted for, and we're going to continue to relentlessly pursue it.
I just wanted folks to hear this is what we're talking about when we talk about trans individuals being asked to leave the military. And Deja, I want to give you a chance to respond, and then we have a bunch of callers. We're going to try to get a few in before as we continue.
I find it interesting and I think Republicans are very good at this, is that they then like say, oh, well, people should be offended that this is being compared to race or ethnicity, or they're very good at telling other people what they should be offended by to get them all riled up. I think that it's also interesting to me that trans women.
Well, I think he was saying they were not the same because the proportions and numbers were different.
I know what he was saying. But then trans women are too strong to be playing in women's sports, but it's, you know, an issue for them to then fight for the country. So I find that a little bit interesting. But also the idea that because somebody transitioned, that it's going to cause all of these issues, you know, amongst the ranks, amongst the whatever. There's already, I mean, how many rapes go unreported and sexual abuse and all kinds of other stories that have come out over the years, and then they have to get that in line because, you know, misogyny used to be a big part of the armed services, and it still is, but a little bit less than it was, right? Like, where do we draw the line? Where do we say we're no longer going to advance as a society? Mm-hmm. We are no longer going to include, we're no longer going to grow as we discover new things and learn new things about people and who they are and what they are, etc. And I think that, that may be true. I'm sure that there are a lot of women that would be uncomfortable showering with, you know, a trans person or whatever. Well, you know what? Then give them another shower time, mm-hmm. or give them separate showers. There's other things to do other than continue to punish people for who they are. And at the end of the day, that's what this does.
And you're saying that there could have been some other accommodations that could happen in the military to not exclude trans people. And by the way, we have so many callers on the line. I want to bring in first David from Fishtown, who's on the line. David, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment? And if you could keep it brief, we have a long line. Yes. David, what's your question or comment?
So I'm an elementary school teacher, right? And to me, everything comes back to like empathy and understanding. And if you want to talk about cohesion, I'm not a veteran, but I do understand how groups of people work together, and you have to understand one another, and you have to have empathy towards one another. And at least at the elementary school age, the biggest way to do that is exposing people to new ideas and to new cultures and to new understandings. And to like for the military, that seems what it would want to be as well. And so I'd love to hear both of your sides about like new ideas and new understandings and how that would help or hurt our military in this way. And, you know, how it pertains to LGBTQAICPD+.
Yeah. Thanks, David. And we'll put the pin in that because I want to get one more caller in before we throw it back to you. We have Chris from Millville on the line. Chris, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, it's more of a comment. Earlier in the conversation, your guest had mentioned that surgeries are not happening. My daughter, born in 1998, when she was 16, without my knowledge nor consent, transitioned, double mastectomy. I was notified in a text. Okay? I have 50% custody of my daughter, who is now my son, who I wholeheartedly support in his transition. But I just want to make the air clear that, yes, it is happening in real time, and I can witness to the fact. So I'd like to correct your guest. And unfortunately, I kind of tuned in halfway through the show. Yeah.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
I appreciate that, Chris. So that's Chris from Millville and David from Fishtown. Real quick, I think on David's point, it's sort of like, all right, so what is the appropriate age, the appropriate approach to introduce young people to, any community, really. We're talking about LGBTQ+ right now, because that has been a huge lightning rod and flashpoint in schools. So Deja and then Albert real quick as we wrap things up.
I'm a firm believer in hate, bigotry, and discrimination is learned behaviors. They're taught by somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think this elementary school teacher really, really nailed it. That if we expose people in elementary school to, hey, there's different people, there's different sexual orientations, there's different gender identities, the kids are going to look at you and say, oh, okay, cool. Can we go back to playing now? they're going to go back to playing, and then they're going to grow up without that ignorance and that bigotry, which is going to cause the issues for trans people in the military. If we started teaching people at a young age that mm-hmm. there are all different kinds of people, there are all different genders, there are all different sexual orientations, and it's okay, it's not a bad thing. Yeah. The reason there can't be cohesion or the argument against cohesion is because in our society, we are taught to dislike or not agree with certain things.
And Albert.
Albert, real quick, sort of like how to address that issue, at what age, with what materials, you know. I think that's something that has popped mm-hmm. up a lot in school districts in this region and across the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a complicated question. I think really the parents need to be in the driver's seat of that, the parents and the families. What is not appropriate is teaching sexually explicit material, which has been found in classrooms and libraries down to the middle school and below level. I do not think that, I think the world is confusing and frankly vulgar enough that you probably want to protect your kids a little bit longer from a lot of this. And just as an anecdote here, I went through my whole high school K-12 experience. Nobody was teaching about anal sex in classrooms. Nobody was teaching anything lewd. Really gay, lesbian, trans stuff wasn't mentioned. And it was okay. And I think a lot of people feel that way, and it's going to be fine. I know it's easy to dismiss that as, you know, gay white male privilege, since we're the, you know, top of the totem pole, according to some people, in this sort of intersectional matrix, which I think has been is kind of a poisonous way to look at the world. But I would just say, you know, TLDR, I think it really needs to be families, certainly not without parents' consent.
Got it.
And I think kids are sexualized at way too young an age.
But we do have to wrap up this conversation, but I want to thank you both for joining us today. You heard right there from Albert Eisenberg, Republican political consultant and principal at the political communications firm Blue State Red. Thank you for your time. And Deja Alvarez, activist and advocate for the LGBTQ+ community. Thank you, Deja, for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you to everybody who emailed in. Yes. And called in today. So many people, so many comments. And thank you, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks, Satina Calicay, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 at WHYY here in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Hey, we'll talk to you tomorrow.